Shrink Wrap Radio number 394, The Benefits of Playing Video Games with Dr. Isabella Gronick.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Isabella Gronick, professor and chair in the Developmental Psychopathology Department at Radboud University Nijmegen in the Netherlands, and lead author of a fascinating article on the benefits of playing video games, which appeared in a recent issue of The American Psychologist. Be sure to go to our website for more biographical detail on Dr. Isabella Gronick. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Isabella Gronick, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm very excited by the topic and eager to get into it. Now, you're professor and chair in the Developmental Psychopathology Department at Radboud University Nijmegen in the Netherlands. I'm sure I butchered that pronunciation. How should it be said?
Actually, almost all of it was perfect, except Nijmegen is Nijmegen, not Nijmegen. But, I mean, I certainly did that for a whole long time before I got out there.
Yeah. Now, you went to school at the University of Toronto for your doctoral work. So are you Canadian? Are you Dutch? What are you?
Yeah. It's not a simple answer, actually. I'm Canadian, yes, but I was born in Romania, and I lived most of my life in Canada, but I spent about 6-7 years in the States as well. And now, indeed, for the last 3.5 years, I've been in the Netherlands.
Wow, what an interesting background. Mm-hmm. And I've heard of departments of developmental psychology, but this is the first time I've ever heard of a department of developmental psychopathology.
Yeah.
So it certainly makes sense to me, but I'm wondering if that's unique to the Netherlands or uniquely European or what?
No, I don't think it's unique to the Netherlands, but the discipline of developmental psychopathology was really sort of pioneered by people like Dante Cicchetti and Alan Stroh and those folks. And so it's also got its sort of flagship journal, Development and Psychopathology. And so it's trying to be a sub-discipline of its own for quite a while. But indeed, a whole department sort of named for that is relatively rare, yeah.
Yeah, sounds pretty unique. Mm-hmm. Well, I was delighted to discover your article in a recent issue of The American Psychologist on the benefits of playing video games. I have the impression that The American Psychologist is not an easy journal to get into. Did you have to do a lot of rewrites?
I actually surprisingly did not, and I have to say I am most surprised by that than almost anything that has taken me through this journey of video games, because also the American Psychological Association isn't particularly positive usually about video games and its impact on children, adolescents, and adults as well. So I was quite shocked at how open they were to this perspective.
Well, maybe they are evolving. I certainly think they have evolved somewhat over the years. And for a long time, I didn't bother to be a member or to go to the conferences because I felt I was so different from them, from quotes them. But then a few years back, I went and discovered that really the field had changed and that there were a lot of people who were more open to a wider array of perspectives than at the time when I first got my degree, when it was pretty much, you know, all behaviorism and all experimental psychology.
Yeah, that certainly resonates with my experience as well. And they have had some really excellent review articles that surprised me as well. One of them that comes to mind is a review on the psychoanalytic approaches and how misinformed we are about the outcomes of psychoanalytic treatment approaches. And I was very surprised that APA would want to put that in there. But it's an excellent article as well.
Yeah, great. Well, as you point out in your article, so much of the research that's been conducted on video games has been on the dangers of addiction and various other negative effects. And part of the reason I was so happy to discover your article is that I've long felt that since video games seem to be so powerfully engaging and motivating, that there should be ways to harness them for positive and healthful uses.
That's exactly it. You just basically summarized the entire thesis of the article. Indeed, yeah.
Okay. Well, as I say, I felt that for a long time, but thinking about it is one thing, and doing the work that it takes to establish that is quite another. And so I'm really impressed by the work that you've done, and even just the work of your review of the literature and so on.
Oh, thank you.
And your review of the literature, not surprisingly, shows that children and adolescents spend an enormous amount of time playing video games.
That's right.
Do you remember any of those statistics off the top? I didn't write them down.
Well, I mean, I think the most common sort of statistic now that is emphasized is that video games are basically ubiquitously played by children and adolescents and adults as well. So it's up to 97% basically of youth are playing regularly, which is approximately anywhere between a half an hour and to an hour a day. It's really across cultures as well. I mean, unless we're talking about very, very poor sorts of context, almost everyone, just like TVs, are, you know, playing games now.
You know, one sort of collateral thought that I had as I was thinking about this, and something that I've reflected about on the show before, is that childhood has changed so much, and at least in this country, kids don't go out and play in the neighborhood the way they used to. They're driven around to ballet and then to soccer practice and then to a play date and so on. Mm-hmm. So, they're in their silos. All of our homes have become like little silos. And so maybe one aspect of, you know, of the social component of video games is a way of sort of trying to reach outside the silo and make contact with other people.
I think it's a great point. And I think that because of this sort of general protectiveness that we have, I'm a mother of 2 7-year-old, almost 8-year-old boys, twin boys. And, you know, coming from Toronto, where we really are always about keeping children inside, or play dates are hyper supervised. And it's not like when I was growing up where I would go out for 6 7 hours on the weekend and my parents had no idea where I was and what cavern or ditch I was playing in.
Exactly.
It's very, very different right now. I think children are growing up indeed a little bit much more protected in that way. And these video games are becoming these virtual playgrounds where they spend a whole lot of time. But, you know, unlike that more stereotypical view of what a gamer or a kid who's playing video games a lot looks like, they're not doing this alone in the basement, you know, kind of locked up and antisocial. They're almost all playing the majority of their games in a social context, either with their friends and peers in the same room, or they're playing online with their friends and peers. And so it's almost always a context where they are playing with others, but indeed not necessarily in fresh air.
Yeah. Hey, incidentally, I'm also the father of twin boys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and because I'm older and my twin boys are grown up now, one of them was really into video games. I've been sort of a computer guy all along. So, you know, so they get some of that from me. And I also have done market research consulting over quite a span of years and got involved in that when the whole personal computer industry was taking off. And so I was doing research work for companies like Atari, which at the time was a major game producer. And so I would bring home these games, and the kids would be the first people on the block to see some of these games, which were still in development. And one of my sons, we were really concerned that maybe he was addicted or just way too involved with video games. And he's still involved with video games. He's like, I lose track after a certain age, but I think he's 32, either 31 or 32. And he still looks forward to playing video games, but, you know, he has a wife and a job and a baby, and So he has become a productive member of the adult community.
Of course.
I'm happy to report.
Yeah, and you know, one of the really, really interesting things about diving into this kind of research in this generation is that most parents now themselves grew up with video games, which is really quite unique to any other cohort, because before that, we can pretty much count on the parents being very much separated from their children's experience of gaming. But now, a lot of the parents that I'm now working with in our research context and clinical context themselves played games and can readily sort of accept the fact that they aren't just evil things in their homes.
To what extent do they provide a kind of bonding experience between game-playing parent and game-playing kids?
Well, that's a fantastic question, and one of the ones that I just cannot wait to get more into in terms of research, and there is pitifully little on this. So the idea of co-generational play is really such a new one in terms of research. Almost nothing is done. We know that play in general bonds people in general. So children do most of their sort of social connecting through pretend play and other forms of play. And we also know that, you know, when kids are young, the adults around them, including their parents and teachers, the best way to bond with them emotionally and to feel close to them is to play games with them. And those, of course, didn't have to be video games. But now, since so much of our world is on this screen, this is a great context in which I think parents can stay connected to their, you know, young adolescents as they get older, and it feels like you're losing touch with them. And I think the context of co-playing with adolescents and parents is a wonderful way to keep that emotional warmness still there, and also allow the adolescent, for example, to take over and lead in one context that, you know, you usually don't get these children able to lead their parents into new learning experiences. But I think it would be wonderful to research the impact on the relationship that it has when children are able to lead their parents in a play context.
I think that's great. I would love to see that research.
Yeah.
I agree with you. That would be wonderful. And, you know, when the video game phenomenon first started to happen, I was very excited about it. Went to video arcades, and Atari had a video arcade on their premises for the development of games. And I got to take one of my buddies in, and we played games all day for free and without having to put quarters in the machine. And we were just so excited about the dawning of this new age. But I quickly discovered that I couldn't keep up with kids, you know, it's like they were so fast. And so I kind of gave up years ago.
Yeah. I totally get that feeling, of course, all the time with my kids, and it is just amazing how quickly they figure out these systems, and there's such different rule structures from one game to another in some ways. Of course, some ways they're very similar, and they're able to adapt so quickly, and all in this very new kind of 21st century learning style of learning as you go through trial and error, rather than, you know, I'm constantly saying, wait, read the instructions. And there's no way. They're just ahead of me, just pressing everything and
figuring
out what to do, you know, as they go.
Right.
It's a really different kind of learning style that these kids have, and it's really effective in some contexts. Of course, not all contexts, but some for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, now, you also point out that I thought this was amazing, given that the Oscars just happened here. You point out that in 2010, video games brought in more than $25 billion in the U.S. alone, which was twice as much as Hollywood's box office sales.
Yeah.
That really speaks to what a huge phenomenon this is.
Absolutely. And it's only growing. I mean, every single sort of estimation by the entertainment industry, by academics and so on, say that the video game industry is just only exponentially growing and going to grow. And really what I'm most excited about is that even the designers and these big sort of AAA companies are starting to recognize that the whole, you know, shoot 'em up, stealth kind of fighting, military kind of games are still there, and they're the blockbusters, of course, but there's this huge burgeoning indie independent game world out there that is just beginning to develop and find its legs. And those games are just incredible in terms of their potential to evoke a whole range of emotions, not just, you know, frustration and, you know, aggression, and which can be fine in some contexts, but things like, you know, awe and a sense of wonder and a sense of social connection and sadness even, and, you know, all sorts of emotions that we never thought games would have anything to do with.
Wow, that sounds very interesting. Now, as a mother, are there games that that you restrict for your 7-year-old twins?
Oh, of course. And I mean, there's the whole idea of there being any kind of benefits or, you know, problems or harms that can come out of games. Of course, all of these things have caveats in terms of the developmental age of your children and the kinds of context that may, there's all sorts of individual differences in children's ability to deal with stressful contexts or sad contexts and so on. So, of course, with my kids, I restrict extremely heavily in terms of content. They're not playing first-person shooter games that are showing any kind of blood. But that's exactly what I do with it in terms of film or books that we read together. And, sure, you know, they haven't gotten past the first Harry Potter book for a good reason, or the movie. And so it's the same idea. And I think care, of course, should be taken by parents. And I think it's one of the things that we need to do as psychologists doing research in this area is do a much, much better job of figuring out the nuances of the gaming effects instead of making them either evil and ready to, you know, teach our children the worst of violent behaviors, or all good and positive and fun. There's a huge range in between there that I think has to be investigated, and we really need to start doing a much better job of that kind of research.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that a more nuanced view is definitely called for, and we do seem to kind of reflexively want to make them not just video games, but in general, to make a judgment about things, pretty much black and white. All this is bad or this is good, rather than, you know, strengths and weaknesses, advantages and disadvantages for some people, and at what times and what contexts, etc.
Exactly. And, you know, you pointed it out earlier that what struck you for a long time has been how games have this incredible potential for teaching new thoughts, behaviors, all sorts of cognitive, emotional, behavioral patterns, because they are so incredibly engaging. They pull you into a world and keep you in that world, because game designers have become these sort of wizards of that kind of engagement. So that can be for anything. And I think we can all agree, even those you know, pretty hardcore zealots of the negative impacts of games, if you're going to suggest that you can have such huge negative, you know, effects of these video games, then surely you have to, in the same breath, acknowledge that context and those engagement potentials have also these amazing good potentials to really create different kinds of behavioral patterns or emotional patterns. And that, I think, is completely untapped, that learning potential in the positive realm.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned earlier that I was involved in market research, and I still am. And so it's interesting to see that in the market research world and in the commercial world, there's a big movement to do gamification on websites and on various kinds of tools, where they're trying to get consumer opinions and to have people be able to earn points and earn little badges, you know, as if they were in a video game.
Yeah.
And evidently, I mean, I say that with a little bit of skepticism. I'm not totally on board with all of that. To me, it seems a little gimmicky. But evidently, it does play into some kind of, I guess, fairly universal thing within us that wants to keep track and wants to know how we're doing.
Yeah, and I think that intuition that we all have about what is so engaging about games is exactly why this gamification movement has taken off so much in advertising and in just the workforce in general. But I think your sort of hesitation is also an incredibly insightful one, because in my mind, a lot of what gamification is about is it's simplifying what games are in a way that completely loses track of the real magic. Mm-hmm. So just putting points on things or making cool graphics that, sort of are associated with the product you're trying to put out there isn't enough to make it into a real game, a game that you walk into and suspend disbelief and engage in practices that allow you to feel in a totally different way than you would in real life. And I think what psychologists have done in the learning context in education, for example, is start to realize that these games might have an impact, but the games we develop are horrendously boring so far.
Yeah, right.
It's God awful. It's this, I shouldn't say this across the board, but there are some real limitations in the ways that we've started to develop these games, because we're novices. We're not artists. We're not, we haven't learned how to use the game mechanics in ways that the commercial world has really been learning for decades. And so we get a lot of really boring learning games, and really there's not actually very few mental health games, but if I have a sense that if we start there, they're also going to be pretty boring at first, like most gamification sort of contexts are.
Yeah, that was actually something I was going to be asking you about, because I had a kind of a similar intuition about that, I guess, because I think when we try to grab hold of something and bend it to a teaching purpose or whatever, often it does violence to fun, basically.
Exactly. Bang on. And in fact, one of the things I do really try to stick to, almost as a religion with games and my kids, is to never, ever tell them that this is a learning game versus other games. So, if they get extra screen time, it's like, you know what? If you do this well, you're going to be able to play that math game, Rocket Math. And I don't differentiate, because I want them to think in ways that all learning is fun in any kind of learning context. And you really lose that when you make it into a quote unquote learning game or educational game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that there's going to be some really fantastic opportunities to combine the art and craft of game design with what we know already in psychology of decades of research. And when you combine those two, and you really, these domains and disciplines talk to each other openly and use their expertise jointly, then I think we have some really great potential.
What you're suggesting, I could imagine that there might be some new academic departments that would emerge.
Yeah, in my ideal world, that's exactly, I'm writing grants and thinking about this so much these days, and it's the idea of really taking what we know in basic psychological science about the etiology of things like anxiety, depression, bullying, and taking also what we know in clinical practice about the best evidence-based practices, that might have to do with things like cognitive behavioral therapy or, exposure treatments and things like that. And you take these two scientific sort of based fields of knowledge and then sit down at the same table before you do anything, before you create anything, with real game designers, commercial grade game designers, and think together about the felt experience you want to create in a game and how you want to change that felt experience to something more positive. And I think there's huge potential in that.
I just had a flash that we're living in the science fiction future.
Yeah. Yeah.
This conversation, couldn't have been had in the 50s or 60s. And I was struck with that this morning when my wife said something about, we should Google that. And I said, that's a line straight out of a science fiction novel or something. A word like Google and Googling that. Before we leave the violence, one of the things that concerns most adults is how violent some of these games are. What does research on the effect of that violence reveal?
Okay. So, I mean, the first thing is that there's been these two meta-analyses done by the two camps, one camp being the, violent video games cause directly children and youth to be violent, and then the other camp being these games have absolutely no effect on children's aggressive behavior. And so these are two meta-analyses conducted on almost the exact same database of studies out there. And they came to radically different conclusions. One of them saying, see, there's obvious evidence for this connection between violence in games and violence in real life. And the other one saying there's absolutely no connection. And the reason for that has a lot to do with boring methodological reasons about how these studies are conducted, but it also has to do with the fact that, violence and aggression is an incredibly complex behavioral pattern. And of course, it has a lot to do with socioeconomic status and parenting. Yeah, so the question is really, what is the real effect research? What does research say about the connection between violent video games and, kids' behavior and adolescents' behavior, right?
Yes, right.
So, when you basically look at, when you have a balanced sort of look at the literature and the hundreds of studies that have been conducted on this connection, what you find is no very convincing direct causal connection. So once you take into account things like socioeconomic status and parenting, which make a huge, huge difference in children's lives and the tendency for them to be aggressive, what video games add to that is very, very small. Now, of course, if you're spending 8 hours a day behind a video game that is shooting up the whole time and you're thinking aggressive thoughts all the time while you're playing this, it primes you. So what you do find is studies that show that after playing a violent video game, you're more likely to have more aggressive cognitions, and you're less likely to perhaps help others. But here's the really interesting stuff that's coming out more recently. The same violent video games, if you play them competitively, you get some of these priming effects of having these negative aggressive cognitions afterwards. But if you play them cooperatively, the same games, you get actually the opposite results. So you get children feeling more helpful towards others afterwards, acting out in more pro-social ways, playing still those violent video games, but in a cooperative way. So that's a really important thing to keep in mind, is how those games are played is just as important as the content of those games.
Fascinating. And maybe this is relevant. One of the games you discuss as an example is the World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
And you point out that 12 million players regularly log on. I was visiting Sweden a couple of years ago, and I was somewhat surprised to discover that my hosts, an adult husband and wife team, are both aficionados of World of Warcraft.
Yep.
Now, that title makes it sound so violent, but these are not violent people. What's the pull? Is it, in fact, one of those cooperative things that you're talking about?
Indeed, and that's the big pull. When you ask World of Warcraft players why they play, overwhelmingly the motivation is the social connection they get. So they are getting into this online world in which you cannot proceed successfully without cooperating with other fellow players who are often, playing across the globe with you. So you go there, you need to have the skills to approach people in, pro-social ways and ask them to join you to play, for example, on the same guild, so on the same team. Mm-hmm. And then cooperatively, you guys have to come up with a plan to go and get the bad guys in a way that everybody agrees. And so you know, and they have these studies now that people who play these kinds of games, so these games where you have to do, to build together teams and go out and accomplish goals together, those are also the people in real life that tend to be more civic minded. So they're the ones that are the ones that tend to volunteer more, who tend to be the ones who go out on campaign trails, political campaign trails, are active in real life, and this is. These are the same people who are drawn to things like World of Warcraft.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, even though there's been little research up to this point on the benefits of video games, you point out that we do know quite a bit about the adaptive functions of play. So, and I know that's a big topic, but what's the role of play and why is it important?
Yeah, this is a near and dear topic to my heart because I started off as my graduate training was in developmental psychology. And the pioneers in this area of developmental psychology, whether it's Piaget or Vygotsky and so many others, John Dewey, all talked about the incredibly central role that play has in children's development. So this, within play context and game context, this is where children learn how to cooperate, how to regulate their emotions. If you look at a four-year-old or a five-year-old who loses at a game, they will immediately start bawling their eyes out. Getting one of these tantrums going. Absolutely. Right. It is so predictable. It's amazing. But they keep playing. And then by six, by seven, thank goodness, by the way, they have learned how to regulate that, those emotions. They know that it's coming. They know that failure is coming, and they already have strategies to cope with that failure. Not only that, but they become resilient in the face of that failure. So they no longer think of failure as something that's a do or die situation, but they learn that failure teaches them something and that they can go back and learn to do it better if they've failed the first or second time. So all of these kinds of, and this has nothing to do with the video context. This is play in general. This is about playing in pretend play. This is about being in playgrounds and falling off of the swings. All play has this sort of simulated simulation aspect to it, that it allows children to role play or practice the skills that are so essential for the rest of their lives. And those are, you know, emotion regulation types of skills, but also social skills as well. And evolutionarily, I mean, I can go on and on about this. Evolutionarily, other animals other than ourselves play.
Yeah.
And that play serves a real important function to create tighter bonds among primates, for example, or to be able to allow for the sort of expulsion of negative emotions like anger in a safe, relatively safe context, and then to move on. So, you know, evolutionarily, it's been selected for this play capacity. Now what we're talking about is some of the same sorts of context, but now they're just online or on the computer, because that's where we're spending a lot of our lives.
Right. Now, you have a section in your paper on the cognitive benefits of gaming. So what are some of those cognitive benefits?
Yeah, so this is probably, if there's one area that's researched most, it is the cognitive benefits of gaming. And what you find there is over and over, and this is even meta-analyses have been done on a whole group of studies now that show spatial skills and other kinds of basic cognitive skills are learned through playing video games. And a lot of this research is done actually with these kinds of they call them action games in our research reports and our journal articles. But in fact, when you look at what the games are, they're first-person shooter games. And these games, overwhelmingly, when you, randomly assign players to either play these violent action games versus other kinds of games, you see that they train people up to be more spatially skilled. And what's important, what's absolutely crucial about that is that spatial skills, there have been longitudinal studies over 25 years that have been conducted showing that spatial skills are one of the most powerful predictors of STEM expertise, so science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Mm. If you are good at spatial skills, if you have strong spatial skills, you're going to be better at those expertise, and those are the ones that we really direly need now to cultivate in our children.
Interesting. Yeah. And you also talk about the motivational benefits of gaming, which we've kind of touched on. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Sure. So this, you know, all the other benefits that I talk about in that article really are less researched. So it's not a, you know, a very, it's not a given fact, let me just say. But with motivational components, so we know, for example, that people go to games on their own volition and they spend hours and hours, sometimes much to our chagrin, in these games. So we know they're motivated to play, and that what we think from some of the gaming literature and some of the psychology of sort of media psychology research is that that state of flow that is so often reported by players is part of the reason why people stay motivated to complete the goals in a game. And so game designers have figured out how to keep players in this what Vygotsky called the zone of proximal development, in this sweet spot of feeling challenged enough, anxious just a little bit to just figure it out and get it right, while not feeling disheartened and that place where you're constantly feeling like you're learning just enough to keep yourself at that edge of just about to accomplish your goals is an incredibly motivating state. And what we think is that some of the research is showing that these kids who are playing these games tend to be kids who have more what some people are calling grit. They are more resilient in the face of failure, and you learn through gaming that you can accomplish whatever goal there is out there if you just put in that time and effort, if you just put in enough of that time and effort. And what a great lesson we want to teach our children.
Interesting. I was also thinking about skiing, which is incredibly motivating, and you know, and you're constantly on your learning edge. At least I am constantly on my learning edge, feeling like, okay, I could get a little bit better, and if I could just do this or just do that. And also, computer programming very much has that quality.
Yeah, and you just named two of some of the most common, you know, tasks that people report feeling flow in, feeling in that state of sort of ideal match between your expertise and the demands of the task.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
You also talk about the emotional benefits of gaming. What comes to mind in regard to that?
Well, I think, you know, one of the most basic things is a lot of people turn to games simply for a rest from their everyday lives and to feel, to basically upregulate positive emotions. It feels good to play that Candy Crush for some reason. And so, you know, when you're feeling stressed and frustrated, you can easily open up one of these casual games and start feeling a little bit better and a little happier. So that's just a basic thing. But also, I think it's a very under researched area. But I think, and one of my passions is to look at how games teach children to regulate their emotions better. So it's such a basic and probably one of the most important things that children and adolescents need to learn to function better in their adult lives is how do you regulate those negative emotions? When I feel really sad, when I feel very anxious, what do I do about that? And how do I work with those emotions to meet my goals? And what I think games do is teach players that things like rumination, which leads to depression as we know, things like that ruminative rehashing of problems and trying to rehash those problems in that exact same way doesn't work. And so it's never rewarded in a game context, doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different outcome. And what is taught is things like reappraisal. Reappraisal is the ability to basically shift your perspective on a seemingly impossible, frustrating, anxiety-producing, whatever situation, and shift that perspective into something that is more positive. And by shifting it, you are able to see entirely new ways of solving a problem. And because games so often change the rules somewhere in between the games, level one and two, you're constantly being trained up to reappraise the situation when you are frustrated. In the actual context of feeling frustration or anxiety, you are forced by the game to shift your perspective. Think of it. Hopefully what you learn is that in your real life context, if you do the same thing, try to shift your perspective rather than getting stuck in that same one perspective that keeps making you feel anxious or frustrated, then you are able to get through it better.
I had the opportunity to hear Jane McGonigal, one of the people you cite. I had a chance to hear her speak at a positive psychology conference some years ago, and she spoke about a game that she developed to help her recover from the brain trauma of a serious automobile accident. She was a very exciting presenter and very motivating, and I rushed to download her iPhone game, which I think is called Super Better.
Yeah.
And it's got reminders or nags to do little activities that would tend to increase one's optimism and happiness. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. And but I found myself after a while ignoring those reminders to do those sensible activities. You know, so something we touched on earlier is the danger that games which have been developed to achieve a serious goal may not in fact be fun or compelling.
Yeah, I really am glad you actually keep coming back to this point in different from different perspectives, because I think it's such a crucial one. I too, by the way, signed up for Super Better. I too love Jane McGonigal. And I was so optimistic that I was going to restart my yoga practice. And, you know, what you just said was that these prompts, nags actually. And it is exactly the feeling I got as well. And this has got nothing to do with Jane McGonigal herself, because I think it's an incredibly difficult, challenging task to make a game that is really, really good. And we underestimate how hard it is. And we have these, as psychologists, we have these really good intentions. But I do think that the fun aspect of the game often gets lost because of those good intentions. And so, you know, my passion really is to work with these talented people who have figured out what's fun, and to listen to them a little bit more than sometimes I'm comfortable with when they keep telling me, that's going to really suck if you put that in the game. Because it's absolutely crucial that it's what the fun factor is, what will get your players to come back the second or third time. And unless we have players playing our games over and over and over again, the very sort of behavioral and emotional patterns we want to improve in them won't be improved, because one of the main things you want a game to do is get players to practice those things. And you only practice in games if you love what you're doing in that game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I see that you also are co-founder of something called the Play Nice Institute. So what can you tell us about the work of your institute?
Yeah. So we founded this institute in order to have a context in which we can develop. So this is really about developing the games, not the research on the games per se, because, you know, my university context allows me to do the research on these games. But really, this is the place where I get to, you know, dream the big dreams of pulling in these commercial game designers and playing with them. And so the idea for the Play Nice Institute is to take to heart this melding of science with the fun of games. And from the get-go, when we are designing a kind of intervention game, we stop even calling them serious games, because what a terrible way of thinking about abuse. And try, so that's what the Playnice Institute was developed for. And we want to make it a place where we can apply for funding so that we can create these very different kinds of games with different kinds of missions in those games, but still have that fun factor absolutely central to it.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Now, do you see in the future, or is this something that you're working on, or sort of mental health interventions?
Talk about that. So this is what keeps me up till 2 o'clock in the morning and gets me out of bed really excited is this idea of taking, you know, in the educational world, it's been, you know, there has been a zeitgeist that's been started about using games for learning. And what I would love to do is try with the Playnice Institute and my colleagues to spearhead a similar kind of revolution in mental health. My sort of dream would be that children would be skipping to their treatment programs for anxiety, or they, you know, a prevention program in a school for bullying would have kids going, oh, it's almost 3 o'clock. We almost get to go and play that game. And in that game, they learn skills that will prevent bullying or victimization. And I think it's really, really doable. We can develop games to promote mental health and to prevent, you know, anxiety, depression, aggression, all sorts of things by using these gaming principles. So that's, yeah, I think it's very doable.
Yeah. Well, what if there are some young people listening to this interview? There might be. I know that we have students and graduate students that listen. What would, if somebody got all fired up, as I would if I were young and listening to this conversation,
yeah,
how would they get their foot in the door to get involved in this kind of work?
Yeah, well, first of all, they can certainly come and come to the Playnice Institute and click on there and send me an email. But, you know, the idea is to find to be the kind of person that really can feel comfortable in that uncomfortable space of not being in one discipline, because I think that creating excellent games for mental health is going to require this multidisciplinary approach that really allows scientists to talk to artists in a different kind of way. And so these young people right now, God, would I ever want to go to somewhere like MIT and learn technology and psychology at the same time and develop these games? But I think there's lots and lots of opportunities, and it's a wide open field. So we've developed a new game. It's our first game that we're really started from the ground up, called Mind Light. And it's such a great example, not because, I mean, yes, of course I'm excited because we developed it, but it's a great example because all of the neuroscience basic research that I got all fired up about is now being applied to a game to change children's anxiety levels. And the fun of creating this game with these commercial game developers, it was unprecedented for us. Like, we just had a ball. And now we have these randomized controlled trials giving kids the opportunity to play this game that has this neurofeedback component so they can change what's going on in the game by just changing their mindsets. And watching how engrossed these kids are and how much fun they're having while, unbeknownst to them, they are learning new emotion regulation skills, I can't tell you what a turn on that is. It's just, it's been fantastic.
Well, I can hear it in your voice.
Yeah, most people can, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Have you had an opportunity to present at MIT?
No, they haven't called me yet.
Well, you might have to call them, because I think that's such a wonderful idea, you know, a place where I think you would find the raw human resources to go in really interesting blended directions.
If you could
inspire a few people there, they're famous for their media lab. Maybe you can figure out a way to get an entree there. I wish I had a contact for you. I don't, but
no, thank you. Yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of contacts I'm trying to make, and it's a really interesting thing being sort of feeling like I'm in mid-career and yet really feeling a novice now, and yet, on the other hand, that's what's so exciting about this new adventure. And, you know, when we get the data for the game for MindLight, I think that's also a sort of new opportunity to start up conversations saying, hey, this actually works. Of course, given that it works, we need the data.
But, yeah.
that's going to be another sort of a way of getting our foot in there and trying to convince people that it's worth it, because so many people still think of games, of course, as these trivial things that you do on the side. And I think if we all just played a little more, we'd realize it's not just that.
Right, right. Now, is this a commercial venture as well?
So far, no, although my colleagues now out in California have started to convince me in a very interesting new way that maybe going commercial is the exact way to go. So part of the – I've been in intervention research for, you know, 15 years. And, you know, the big problem for us is even when we have a program that works relatively well, the dissemination of those programs or those techniques or those ideas is such a slow-moving process. And uptake is really slow in schools and so on. Whereas when you have a game, and if you actually made the game fun enough that somebody would want to take it off the shelf to play just for the sake of playing,
yeah,
the impact you can have is, I mean, it's exponential from what we've already had. So instead of having to go to a school and ask for a program or whatever, you can just download a game. I think that impact would have a much, well, we would have much bigger impact in terms of promoting children's mental health. So that's how I've gotten started to thinking. I haven't gone much further than just starting to think about the commercial possibilities, because it gets the game and the intervention in kids' hands who it would never have otherwise been in, and also families and parents playing with their children. So commercializing now is something that we are thinking about for that reason.
And when will you have the data in on MindLight?
So MindLight's the randomized control trial should be done in May, and then we'll know a lot more. There's this conference called Neurogaming that I'm going to be presenting in May in San Francisco, so I'm hoping to present that data. But I'll certainly also put up, you know, our findings on the website as well. So it's really going to be very, very soon, and we're going to be comparing it also to, you know, standard conventional treatment programs, and I want to see if we at least do as well as them, but also if the motivation for these kids is higher so that they would share these games with their friends, because you can imagine then the impact just grows exponentially.
Yeah. Boy, I might want to attend that conference in San Francisco since I live not that far away. Neurogaming, it sounds, again,
doesn't that sound great?
Very, very science fiction future-y.
Absolutely, it does, yeah.
Well, as we wind down, I wonder if there are any final points you want to make?
That's a good question. You know, I think my main point that I want to get out is this call to researchers and psychologists to open up their minds and their labs to the powerful impact that games can have on children and families' lives, and to start thinking together about research programs that, as we talked about, investigate the nuances, the bad with the good, the social and the antisocial, and try to put a foundation, a stronger foundation, scientific foundation, underlying this game research, so that the products we come up with are just all the more effective and engaging. That's really, it's just more of a call for research and practice, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Isabella Gronick, it's been absolutely delightful speaking with you, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you for really reaching out, and I've had a lot of fun with this, so thanks.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Isabella Gronick. Although she teaches in the Netherlands, she was actually in France during the Skype conversation. As I'm sure you could tell, I'm very excited about her work. I think she's living out one of my fantasy lives. I think she's really on the cusp of groundbreaking work and the possible emergence of a whole new discipline within the field of psychology. I have so much admiration for the way in which she's able to embody both academic rigor and excitement of doing pioneering work. As you heard, I'm not a big video gamer. It's pretty clear that that's a generational thing. I'm much more into the digital world than most of my generation, but I think it's the generation of my children and later who were born into a childhood where video gaming was as natural and common for them as roller skates were for mine. However, you may recall that my good friend Jerry Trumbull, whom you've often heard on this show, and I did set off together to explore the world of Second Life. And it was very exciting for both of us for a while. We entered into a strange world of exotic avatars and magical powers, and a world in which some players were making real money selling virtual real estate and other virtual goods. If I were not so consumed by my first life, I could imagine myself spending a lot more time there. I wonder what has gone on in our absence, if there have been any major changes in that world. Oh well, maybe when I retire, haha. If you didn't hear it, I think you'd be very interested in Shrink Wrap Radio number 143. I believe Jerry and I discussed Second Life in a wide-ranging discussion in that episode. And then if you're at all interested in this topic, you really should go back and listen to Shrink Wrap Radio number 157 on the psychology of Second Life with author Wagner James O., who wrote the 2008 book, The Making of Second Life, Notes from the New World. And from April 2003 to February 2006, he was a contract writer for Linden Labs, the creators of Second Life, primarily hired by that company to cover Second Life as an embedded journalist in an emerging society, its controversies, its personalities, its innovations, and ambitions, along with larger themes of identity, social norms, and organization and cultural expression important to online worlds in general. I think it might be time for Jerry and me to pay Second Life another visit. And if you're deeply involved in video gaming or socially interactive role-playing games, drop a line about your own experience and impressions. Have your experiences contributed to your own social, cognitive, or emotional growth? Be sure to post your thoughts in the comments area for today's episode.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lara Just. I'm a qualified therapist in London, and I'm also just about to embark on a very exciting postgraduate research about therapists' use of client-generated metaphors. Next to this, I also work as a mind-body practitioner, coach, nutritionist, and change manager at a big NHS London hospital. I decided to support the work of Dr. Dave because his podcast has been a staple nourishment, so to speak, for me throughout the past year or more. It's been so relevant for me and my training and personal development. I just love listening to one of his latest podcasts, especially while on a run along the river. I really enjoy Dr. Dave's way of engaging so personably with his interviewees, some of the most exquisite speakers in the field from around the world. The diversity and variety of topics and speakers really convey Dr. Dave's efforts to give listeners the breadth as well as some depth of knowledge. I also really like that Dr. Dave appears to be so open-minded, bringing in some newer thought models in the holistic and mind-body-spirit fields. For me, the podcast series has been fantastic. And if you think so too, please support Dr. Dave so he can continue with his amazing job. So get onto your smartphones or computer now, go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and press on the green donate button. Really, it only takes a couple of minutes. Thank you, Dr. Dave. Please keep your podcast going with many more interesting topics and for many more years to come. Lots of love from London.
Well, thank you so much for that, Laura Just. Lots of love and gratitude to you there in London and to all of you who are helping to financially support this show at whatever level is possible for you. I'm happy to announce that we do have a new transcript on the site, just in time for today's show. Whew! And once again, this is thanks to champion transcriber Gloria Ullman. I'm talking about Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 382 on healing developmental trauma with Dr. Lawrence Heller. So you'll find a link to that free transcript on the interview page with Dr. Heller, as well as on the transcripts page at shrinkwrapradio.com. Please consider helping out by becoming a one-time or occasional transcriptionist yourself. Do send me an email if you wish to volunteer. In other news, I'm sad to report that I've decided to part with the Armed Forces Radio Network. I initially was very excited by that affiliation, but have cooled off on it. You might recall my announcement 2 or 3 months ago about the opportunity to post selected episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio on the Armed Forces Radio Network. I'm always eager to expand our audience, our community, and it seemed to me that there might be many in the armed services who could benefit from the sorts of content that we share here. I had the fantasy that there might be psychically wounded warriors out there who might discover hope and revitalization through the podcast. During the Second World War, the Armed Forces Radio Network was indeed an important outreach to American service people and embassy personnel throughout the world. I now think I understand that the Armed Forces Radio Network has been dormant for some time, and that the individuals who approached me about contributing to that network were hoping to jumpstart it again. For my part, however, I heard from no listeners, even after offering a cash reward to the first person contacting me to say they heard the show through the AFRN. Well, it just doesn't make sense for me to continue if there aren't people listening. I did check out the other content that was put out on the network, and I think for the most part it was pretty incompatible with Shrink Wrap Radio, so I just don't think it appeals to the same sort of audience. And it was taking me extra time and effort to reformat the episodes for the AFRN, which I was happy to do if I felt it was having some positive benefit. I decided it wasn't, however, and so I'm moving on. Finally, let me remind you that it's not too late to take part in the 10-session discussion that Jungian analysts Pat Berry and Robbie Bosnack are having on James Hillman and his approach to alchemy. You can listen and participate live or receive the audio recordings. In addition, there are continuing education units available for this experience. The series is brought to you by my strategic partners, the Jung Platform and the Depth Psychology Alliance, and you can purchase individual sessions for $15 or get the whole series of 10 sessions for $139. Be sure to take advantage of my discount code to save 15%, though. That code is Dr. Dave, which has to be spelled D-R-D-A-V-E, no punctuation. I think it's an excellent value and encourage you to take advantage of this opportunity. To get all the details and to sign up, please click on the banner ad for the Jung Platform in the left-hand sidebar of our site. And in doing so, you will join a number of other Shrink Wrap Radio listeners who have already taken advantage of this offer.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hey, there's a blast from the past. Now let's listen to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Richard in Canada, who in part writes, "Thanks again, Dave. Your work is touching so many people and introducing so many of us to great material that can significantly enrich our lives. It must give you a great sense of contribution to the greater good. Keep it up. You are very appreciated. Richard." Well, Richard, thanks very much. That means a lot to me, especially coming from you, who I know to be a deep and careful thinker. Next, we hear from Bree, who writes, "Hi, David. I just wanted to send you a quick note along with the donation I just made, and like many of us have been meaning to make for years, actually. I want to thank you for your lovely, gentle presence. You ask your guests the exact questions I want to know, and I resonate with your brand of curiosity and spaciousness. You're doing a wonderful thing. Have a great week." Well, Bree, thank you for that encouragement. And these notes of encouragement come at an especially good time because I'm under the weather now for going on 2 weeks, and it's hard not to get discouraged in the face of that. I'm sure you know what I mean. And finally, we hear from Ralph in Germany about more of his own extensive adventures in psychotherapy. Ralph writes, "Dear David, I noticed that you saw the similarities between Heller's therapy and the memory reconsolidation of Eckhart, Tolle, and Tissot. And then you asked Heller," he's referring to my interview with Dr. Lawrence Heller, "about a window of 5 hours that the memory is open during the memory retrieval. He said that he knew nothing about that. I can draw from my memories of misadventures in therapy to report that Eckhart," that's Bruce Eckhart, "as usual, is right. I saw a hypnoanalyst about 25 to 30 years ago. This therapist had traveled to the UK to learn this type of therapy, which is very much like what Joseph Breuer tried to teach Freud. In parentheses, he says, the therapist claimed that Freud was a lousy hypnotist and had never caught on to what Breuer was trying to teach him. In parentheses, I had been hypnotized before and had expected to be told to relax, and then I would be given a suggestion to counter a trauma-based symptom. This guy was what the Jungians call daimonic. He used no suggestions. He only followed memories by associations. I experienced an abreaction that would have impressed Freud and Breuer. Afterwards, I felt as if I had been punched repeatedly in the belly muscles by Mike Tyson. The therapist asked me if I wanted to make another appointment and repeat the process. I told him that I would have to think about it. Now, before the hypnosis, the therapist had taken a very careful history of me that had taken several hours. This guy was no rookie shrink. What impressed me was this. For 5 hours after this memory retrieval and abreaction, I felt as if some part of my brain had opened up. It was exactly what Eckhart describes in his interviews with you. I felt at the time as if some part of the therapy was missing and that I had been re-traumatized. Needless to say, I did not make another appointment. Many thanks for your fascinating interviews." And that's from Ralph in Germany. And Ralph, I have to say many thanks for your fascinating adventures at the hands of a variety of psychotherapists. And with that, I think I'll wrap it up for today. I'll even shrink wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-309-4707. And you can also leave voicemails on our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. And thanks to all of you who have downloaded and are using the app, by the way. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Isabel Gronick, for sharing her exciting work on the benefits of playing video games. Be sure to listen next time when my guest will be Jungian analyst Deborah Bryan, and we'll be discussing her book, Lessons of the Inca Shamans, in which she recounts her journey of initiation. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.